Get ready. It's time to tee it up with Keith Jones.
Coming up on today's show, we welcome back research scientist and therapist Rye Stinson. So stay tuned to get ready as you tee it up with Keith Jones. Welcome to the show. Glad you could be with us as always in this hour. Well, we haven't had this happen in such a long time. I can't even think of when over all the years. But every once in a while, you have on a guest that's so good, you get so much positive feedback that you have to invite them back on in a short period of time. Now, we introduced you to this guest just a couple of weeks ago. And apparently, I don't know, it was the John part, the Hopkins part, whatever it was. There's more than one John. There's more than one Hopkins. It's John's Hopkins. And it's Rye Stinson, who is also part of Outperform Golf and an occupational therapist. I'm not sure. And that great show that we did a couple weeks ago, Rye, what attracted people so much to it? Maybe because you were so helpful. Maybe because people can relate, because people have injuries no matter whether you want them or not. I am not sure, but welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it being on the show, and happy to help however I can. Keep the conversation going, and it's awesome.
Well, you know, it's all about injuries. When you're playing golf, and you see this at the top levels, you know, the guys at the Augusta last week were struggling, and, you know, and just – aches and pains, and this is out of joint and that's out of whack, and it affects all of us. This crazy game that we play has ill effects on people in many ways.
It does, and it also has a lot of good too, right? Like it's amazing how much positive there is, and how very quickly that can all be overshadowed in injury, and it's certainly not a enjoyable thing to be walking around with pain in any environment. Especially participating in something that's as enjoyable as golf is for so many folks, right? I think one of the other tolls that can be taken is managing pain over a long period of time and what impact that can have mentally as we think about ourselves and movers and things. And oftentimes we'll see patients and clients that are very much in the midst of almost like a hamster wheel of, I play and I feel terrible and so on and so forth and back and forth. And it's not a very fun place to be in, but there are resources and there's folks to help.
Well, like yourself, it's interesting that Johns Hopkins is doing what they're doing. It's outside of Baltimore. Baltimore's, I guess, the headquarters. That's where the main hospital is. Mm-hmm. You correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. I have enough knowledge to be dangerous and a little experience with the big JH on an ongoing basis. So I'm happy that the people are around and their offices all over the place. And yours is in Columbia, Maryland, which is, if you're looking at a map, kind of closer to Baltimore than Washington, D.C., but kind of in the middle. So you're in a prime location.
We're smack dab in the middle. We have, you know, one of the main downside to downtown is just getting in and out. Anytime you're in a major city or traffic or all the potholes in Baltimore, parking, it can be tricky. So one of the sort of expansions of the hospital, just like so many other systems, is to move out into the community where maybe I'm not driving super far to get to this appointment or that. And a lot of the, you know, amazing providers that spend time downtown are certainly out in these community locations. And a couple of our locations, which are Green Spring, White Marsh, Odenton, Smonium, two of them in particular, we actually have a beautiful golf sports simulator. And I'm very fortunate enough to be in Columbia. It's one of the things that drew me there and the opportunity to build up a program where we could work with golfers, other Rotary athletes, and so on and so forth. But to have a space where you get a chance to actually see somebody do what they're describing. You know, a lot of times in outpatient rehab, you're kind of crammed into certain places and just sort of make things work. And believe me, I've been there, and you're out in the parking lot throwing a ball around or in the hallway or something. But it's a different deal when you can actually have a space to observe movement and look for some different things and have somebody have a chance to show you what they're talking about. I think that's incredibly valuable. And that's really the main purpose behind having such great equipment and such a space. You know, it's tough to find.
Yeah, but that's so uniquely interesting because you would not expect. Now, I've been around enough doctors to know they love the game of golf. Not to a person, but, yeah. You know, they can do that. And that's part of where the executive courses came from, because these guys wanted to go out in the middle of the day and just play a quick nine holes and get back. So, you know, a lot of history goes back with those kind of professionals. But why is a renowned organization like Johns Hopkins getting into and around the game of golf? How does that happen?
You know, I think that from the sports simulator standpoint, you know, that touches a lot of bases besides just golf, right? There's more things that this can do. I mean, I've had some pediatric patients, and we're playing zombie dodgeball, having a great time. On my end, one of the things that I had just begun and started that when I was at a place called ProFlex Physical Therapy before I came to Hopkins was building up the idea of this golf performance program where all of a sudden you have a specific group of people that you're very familiar with from a an actual sports standpoint, a mental standpoint, a physical standpoint as far as the demands and such. And there's something that you do for such a long period of time in life, hopefully. And the likelihood of some sort of injury, this, that, or the other, is pretty high. And it's also very likely that, you know, so many of our patients are returning to golf or other things. So it makes a lot of sense from a rehab standpoint to adapt and say, hey, you know what? It's a great service and offering to have. It's always very comforting to know that when you go in somewhere and you've got something going on health-wise, you know, like, hey, this person gets me. They understand what I'm trying to return to. They understand, like, why I'm trying to do this, X, Y, and Z. And on my end, circling back here, I had actually been given the freedom to help build and create such a program at the place I was before. But it was, you know, they knocked the ceiling down a little bit. And so I made some room for it up, actually. And so I could actually start to see some folks. And my girlfriend at the time, now wife, actually was already with Hopkins. And our director, Ken Johnson, approached me and said, hey, you know, we're putting in these, we're building these brand new facilities. We're going to be putting in these golf simulators. And if you would like to come take a look, I mean, you know, the idea of a golf program makes a lot of sense and certainly made a lot of sense to me. So that's sort of maybe the origin on that. But I mean, on a regular basis, I mean, you know, the numbers on the millions of golfers in the United States and around the world. It's such a common thing. And to be able to have a really in-depth, adequate service around that, as well as, of course, you know, I don't want to limit our clinic to only golf. I mean, we see so many folks who do so many amazing things. It could be a, you know, a horse racing jockey, a table tennis pro, you know, I'm just listing random things that happen to have come up in the past week or whatever. But, like, you know, it's nice to have all of these options and to be able to build something where, you know what, hey, I feel like I've got a spot and being linked into a system where somebody understands my health background and so on and so forth, that's so valuable. And it makes a lot of sense.
Talking to Rye Stinson of Johns Hopkins, well, you call it golf program. I'm not sure what to call it there. I don't know how to get to be Ken Johnson, the director. I'm going to talk about Ken in the next segment. I'm going to save enough time to be able to delve into that thing. But from your standpoint, Rye, thank you very much, because I'm not sure what show you would ever listen to where somebody would talk about a jockey and a table tennis champion on the same segment. So that, thank you for that. That's definitely a first.
You're welcome.
We've had a number of firsts on this show, but that would be a first on that one. But, you know, I'm sure that the jockeys are running at Pimlico, or what was Pimlico, now Laurel. what would you hold the Preakness, and you know, it's the thoroughbreds go deep in the state of Maryland. As a lot of people don't realize until it comes around to the Triple Crown, and you're like, how did Baltimore get in there? It's because, and it goes back to the great Jim McKay as well, who was a great broadcaster. And a guy was a Maryland horseman along the way too. So yeah, it's interesting in that neck of the woods, and it's a fascinating state because it's a lot like well, there are a couple out there, but North Carolina comes to mind too because they have the mountains and the Atlantic Ocean, and then a lot of stuff in between, in suburbia and urbia, and also rural urbia. So all those words, you know, some of those I made up, but there might be real words by the time we get off of there. I will check with AI and we'll see what happens on that. So, but I digress.
We've got it all.
Because we've got it all. Well, it's, you know, and I think
it's probably one of the,
No, it's probably one of the what? Go ahead.
It's probably one of the coolest things in my world is that I've seen folks from just about every imaginable walk of life, every job, every this, that, or the other. And I think that's such a cool thing. And I've learned so much from folks in all these different spaces, whether you're a CEO or you drive the garbage truck or it doesn't really matter. I mean, these are all folks that I've seen, and there's so much learned from all of those scenarios, and I just figured I would throw that out there because sometimes we can see variety and oh my gosh, they don't just see golfers. I can't believe it. Of course not. That's one of the reasons that I'm a clinician than I am is because I've seen so many different things in so many different settings. But I certainly do work with a lot of golfers, but you can pull a lot of stuff that you've learned from so many other different sports or careers or so on and so forth into what we can add to a golfer's performance and overall recovery if they're recovering from a particular injury.
But Ryan, I can say something similar about this show and about the game of golf. It is a great unifier, and I have had not only diversified the group of guests on this show over time. Everybody wants to be, all the musicians want to be a golfer, and all the golfers want to be musicians, et cetera. Yeah. And then the legends like Gary Player and stuff, who had a fantastic ceremonial tee shot last week at the Masters, going strong. And, you know, when you're 90 years old and you can still swing a club that's like that, that's pretty amazingly fascinating. But there's a guy right there as an example. He has been pitching health and fitness and push-ups and everything else for many, many decades.
He has. And, you know, it's one of the things I run into sometimes, and I like to share different anecdotal stories, and I speak in a lot of analogies and things to put stuff into perspective and help folks understand things. You know, sometimes I'll see folks that are maybe I'm an aging athlete or just aging in general, and I think, well, maybe exercise or strength training isn't necessarily for me, or I shouldn't do this, or I don't want to make this worse. I can hang on, so on and so forth. Actually, share a story about my grandfather. My grandfather started powerlifting when he was 75. And he went on to set, I think at the time, national bench and squat records for 80, 85, and his last competition was at 90. and I share that not to say, oh my gosh, you know, this is incredible, but more of like, well, wait a minute, you know, there is room here for me, and that is possible. It might not necessarily be possible for everyone, but the idea of being active, having fitness and so on and so forth, be part of your life is a really cool thing. Sometimes it kind of gets maybe shoved down your throat a little bit, like this is what I should do or I have to do. We see if we can turn some of those things into get to's.
Yeah, sounds good. We're with Ry Stinson. Head into our first break. Don't worry, he's spending the hour with us, and we'll be back on Tee It Up with Keith Jones. With Ry Stinson of Johns Hopkins fame, occupational therapist, but really This guy is quite a golfer in his own right, been the player, and obviously Ken Johnson, the director there in Columbia at the golf facility, decided, hey, Rye might be a good person for this. What I'd like to know first and foremost, before we get to this zombie dodgeball thing, which has been bugging me since the last segment, how do you get to be the director? I know how you get hired. You know, the director likes you. I got how you got your position. But how do you get to be director? Not that Rye's going to take over for Johnson anytime soon. However, Stinson, you have to aspire. So,
director. I might have to drag him on the show. I would say probably a director of anything is again, be able to process and succeed after a number of failures. I think that some of the best leaders and directors that I've been around will either lead via their own best strategy, some people by example, some people by from afar or up close or whatnot. But I think probably a big deal of that is to be able to take hits and keep moving forward and keep believing in yourself is probably the best way to become a director. That and like with anything in life, probably timing and openings, just like, you know, a window happened to open for me to be able to join the Hopkins family and to build a program, or at least get the process going for building it to levels in which we want to see it get to. So probably the old cliche, a combination of opportunity, timing, and some degree of persistence. So
yeah, but if you do it right, though, and Ken do this right, not that you haven't been doing it all along, I mean, this is a prototypical, right? So this is an opportunity to take this and kind of franchise it, if you will. Johns Hopkins, are you listening? And take it to other locations.
Yeah,
you're far East Coast, but you got a Midwest post you could have, and obviously on the left coast, they certainly could use something like this, because athletes are all over the place, golfers are all over the world, as you mentioned. So it's interesting.
It's a beautiful vision. We're not there yet, but I will say it is interesting. I was just actually having another great conversation with some league clinicians at Duke are looking to do a similar thing, and they actually reached out as far as, hey, how do we kind of build up and do X, Y, or Z and collaborate on some stuff? And I think that's one of the coolest things is the opportunity for collaboration with these programs. Imagine, two really powerful entities like Hopkins or Duke or something turning out a study that has a really unique impact on how we think about maybe a return to sport, or perhaps even the advice you might give somebody with regard to a certain exercise or movement or injury-inducing swing mechanic noticed on 3D or X, Y, or Z. And I think that to me is incredibly intriguing. And obviously anybody on the call very interested in participating in that, certainly please feel free to reach out, because it's absolutely high on my interest of things to do from a collaborative standpoint. And I think that would be a beautiful thing to leave behind as far as not just a program, but honestly a positive impact on a sport or in a game that I really enjoy and care about. So that'd be awesome.
All right, well, don't let the dark blue school steal your ideas, because, hey, that does happen. It does, those guys, you got to watch out. Shady, from that standpoint. I'm so intrigued. I played dodgeball growing up. So you played it in elementary school, you played in middle school, or junior high is what we called it, but hey, it's only high now. What the heck is zombie dodgeball? And why are your poor patients being called zombies and playing dodgeball? That's what I want to know.
Well, all right. So I'll give you the why first.
Yeah, do that in 45 seconds, or just do part of it, and then we'll come back at bottom of the hour break and finish it up, because I don't know how long-winded Rye Stinson's going to get here. So.
Well, you got to brace for impact with that. You never know. The short version is zombie dodgeball is one of the multiple featured games on a full swing simulator It's actually one where the broadcaster or whatnot is actually kind of nice. The basketball game, God, he's just such a jerk. He's just so mean. But one of the reasons we love different activities and things that can be very engaging is that you can immerse yourself in those and built into something, you know, a typical occupational therapy setting, you might look around like, gosh, they're just playing and having fun.
Heading to the bottom of the hour break, we'll be back with more Zombie Dodgeball Explanation.
The Dalai Lama. So I'm on a first tee with him. I give him the driver. He hauls off and whacks one. Big hitter. The Lama. Long. Into a 10,000 foot crevice right at the base of this glacier. You know what the Lama says? Gunga Galunga. Gunga Gunga Galunga.
And we're back to start the second half of the show, spending with Ry Stinson. I knew it was going to be a longer answer than he was letting on. So
I'm sorry, man. What you got?
Not to be sorry about. See, that's good.
You called me.
Is that what happened? When do you guys called him? Yeah, I know we did. Because again, the popularity of the show a couple of weeks ago exceeded anybody's expectations, and there you go. So this is what has happened. We have opened up the box that we may not get shut again, but that's okay because Ry's a decent resource to have. So there you go. From that stand, and he has a good sense of humor because he knows we're kidding with him. For the most part, enough, you know, but the decent part anyway. But back to the zombies. Okay, so zombie. Yep. Dodgeball is on the simulator. I've never played it, so all excuse right. my ignorance. And I've hit a few things in the simulator, so yeah.
I mean, I don't know what you've been doing, but you have not been living if you haven't played Zombie Dodgeball. I mean, my God. You can throw all sorts of different, like you could give somebody a different weighted ball or one with a different texture or something they had to process and figure out, hey, I've got to throw it a certain amount or exert a certain amount of force to get it into the screen, and it reacts into the screen and it goes to hit these zombies. And the crazy thing is you can even change the different settings. You can have zombies on a cornfield, zombies on a carnival. That one is really creepy. The scariest thing is once you finish killing these zombies, right? Like they're approaching, you're trying to hit them with the ball or whatever so that they back up. Like you hit them, they back up, and they're approaching, and eventually they beat you. And when they beat you, they jump out at you, which can be terrifying if you're a little kid, and an adult. But after that, to add insult to injury, they started like this whole coordinated dance, and it's pretty ridiculous. So yeah, so we have zombie dodgeball and just about every sport you can think of on the simulator, but it does get used for golf quite a bit more, but nothing like a good game of zombie dodgeball.
As the great Scooby-Doo would say, zoinks! So, there you go. I don't know. Did anybody follow that? I guess they did. I don't know. That's why you have patience with your patients. You know. I digress on that.
There you go.
So you make it. What do you think? I think that Ry is saying is he tries to make this painful physical therapy fun as well, and you don't know you're getting physical therapied until it's over.
Now we're pretty clever like that sometimes. an activity is kind of a powerful thing. And if you would think, you know, hey, I've got to sit here and do one rep of moving my thumb up and down, that's not really what hand therapy is about. And it's amazing how much we can call upon a familiar motor pattern. You've heard a lot of people in the motor learning space talk about these things where our brain kind of has these things stored forever and our movement patterns, and we can kind of call upon them. The idea that you can, you know, ride a bike, even if you haven't ridden a bike for a long time. So being able to take advantage of that, being able to create a familiar movement or scenario, like throwing a ball or picking up a small item and shifting it or translating it in your hand, all of a sudden now we have a whole bunch more motion in an area that we're targeting because we were stimulating that part of your brain to go, wait a minute, oh yeah, I know this movement. It's familiar to me. And yes, that certainly can be much more engaging. We add some engagement, a familiar motor pattern, and all of a sudden now the muscle activity, the brain-to-hand connection or arm connection or body connection is off the charts. So that's why we do some of these things, pulling back the curtain a little bit. That pretty much sums it up.
So in the last show we did, you talked about nerve transfer, and that's still... intrigues this,
yeah,
this host.
Can of worms. Yeah.
Yeah, it still intrigues this host, in case you couldn't tell, that I just came up with with a term that I'd never heard before a couple weeks ago with Rice. And we've had many conversations, believe, before we came on the air, in the past. So go explain that, because people have neuropathy. They have all kinds of things that affect their golf game, but their everyday life.
Yeah, let me put some of that into some perspective. So some of the common things that are maybe slightly less common, but still relatively common to an occupational certified hand therapist to treat would be perhaps some complex nerve-related injuries and maybe pertaining to the brachial plexus. So I'm going to clarify some of these terms so I'm not just throwing jargon at you. So if we think of like nerves rooting out of your neck as maybe a fuse box and they scoop down to that area in your armpit, they're diving under some narrow spaces underneath your collarbone and your first rib and sprouting off, almost like the branches of a tree, if you will. And in some scenarios, when people have either traumatic injury or perhaps a traumatic injury, so maybe if you had a cancerous tumor removed in a certain area close to one of these key locations from nerve function, or perhaps trauma, like, hey, I dislocated my shoulder, or I maybe have an extra rib, or the outlets that these nerves travel through are abnormally narrow for me. And in any event, sometimes thereafter, there's significant dysfunction, and where we don't have muscles firing or engaging. And one of the really critical things for a hand to be able to do is to bring your hand to your face. And there are certain requirements for that. You need to be able to bend your elbow a certain amount and close your fingers and move your shoulder a certain amount. And restoring those critical elements of function are always on the minds of orthopedic and plastic and neurosurgeons in these scenarios, as well as subsequent therapists who see these patients. Now, I'm certainly not going to pretend to say that I see more nerve transfers than anybody at Hopkins from a therapy standpoint. We have a couple of therapists that see even more than we do in Columbia. But all of us, to a degree, are absolutely familiar with some of these processes. And these are not, I don't want to introduce this like, oh my gosh, they just willy-nilly grab a nerve and move it over and plug it in like a simple circuit board and some of the anatomy seems kind of simple that way, and it just all of a sudden it starts working. This is a scenario where hopefully we'll see some activation over the course of a typical nerve regenerative period, which might be 1.5-2 years-ish. So I don't want listeners thinking, oh man, nerve transfer, I need one of those. If we're in a scenario where we're considering nerve transfer and then perhaps tendon transfer, if a nerve transfer fails, we're usually, there's some stuff going on. So I think the reason that came up last week is what was coming to my mind for the day, like, you know, what else did I see today besides a golfer or this sort of thing? It happened to be that, so along with a number of other things. So these are things that are relatively somewhat commonplace for certified hand therapists, whether they're physical therapists or occupational therapists, to see and treat. And oftentimes there are some very specific post-operative positioning and immobilization strategies, like custom orthotics, which I make on a daily basis. And to go along with that, some targeted specific exercises and we'll call them real neuromuscular retraining of, hey, how do I figure out how to fire and overload an area of a donor site of either nerve or tendon or so on and so forth. That's probably a much better summary of that particular diagnosis.
Okay, that sounds good. You know, that's sometimes you get what you ask for, and you know you weren't quite ready for it. But now I think I have a little better understanding of that. You want to stay away from that nerve transfer thing if you can. Yeah. I think is what I got out of that. You know, having
Sounds like a pretty darn good plan.
Yeah, exactly. But when you are teaching transfer when you're dealing with golf though, because you're doing weight transfer, you're doing a lot of movements, a lot of flexibility and stuff for the patients. But expound a little bit for the people who don't suffer from those kind of things and how they can keep themselves from suffering from those kind of things and make themselves more fluid, if you will.
I think one of the best things in general when it comes to training is to approach training as a skill that we learn over a lifetime and develop. So there's probably no scenario where we're always moving or training perfectly or we'll say optimally. I think one of the best things that we can do in life in general, and not just to phrase it as like, I'm just going to avoid all injuries. That's not really a feasible thing. Like stuff is changing. Our bodies are changing. There's an endpoint for us, right? I think one of the best things that we can do though is to surround ourselves with a combination of digestible knowledge that matches our learning style and some kind of feedback system. So things that I really look for and hope to see in my patients and clients is that we have them moving as well as that they can be moving. And they have a good understanding of systems in place for them so that they can check in on that. And what I mean by that is, so it's one thing to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to start training. I'm going to do some lifting or I'm going to go to this class. And so some of these things are really, they're fantastic. But is your current level of movement quality and control, does it match the demand of the specific thing that you're seeking? And a lot of times, sometimes it doesn't line up so well. So like, hey, I want to go take this class. I want to get more fit. I go to this class. Now this person's really fit. They're moving through this. They're very conditioned to these movements. Some of my movements don't look so good. And this is just too much. And then of course there's the other side, like, hey, I'm afraid to move. I don't want to do too much. And then that's not so good either. But having a process for learning to where I'm not afraid of like, oh my gosh, I need perfect technique all the time. You can't quite learn like that. You have to have a chance to make some mistakes. But working with a really great trainer is something that I often am quote unquote graduating folks to or encouraging folks to, because there's a chance to create a great feedback system for how am I moving right now. So if you look at folks that are playing on tour and so on and so forth, they have these incredible teams around them. And the objective a lot of the times is to say, hey, let's just see if we can keep you somewhere in the middle of this horseshoe. So I'm monitoring this, that, and the other. The player can just show up. I'm just going to try and do what you say. And they're monitoring my quality of movement. They're monitoring this, that, the other, all with the idea of, hey, can I keep you in a pretty optimal range? The average person without a giant, PGA Tour-like team or professional athlete team around them, unfortunately doesn't quite get that experience most of the time from a learning standpoint. So what we try to do, or what I try to do is sort of create that as much as we possibly can with whatever resources that you have or we have in our space. And everyone's different in there, right? Like you can't just tell everybody, oh yeah, go spend hundreds of dollars on a trainer or this, that, and the other. And one trainer is different than the other and all kinds of things. But it's some of these key concepts. So I think my takeaway for the listeners is think about, hey, how can I approach this as a skill that I'm learning and developing in my fitness and my training versus, hey, I'm someone who just exercises. And then what kind of feedback systems can I surround myself with that really help me get the most out of this? And it becomes something that, yeah, gosh, is really enjoyable. And I think that's probably one of the best things that we can do.
Interesting. I was talking to Ryan Stinson, who is with Johns Hopkins, and that's his main thing. He also hangs a little shingle called Outperform Golf LLC and is a good player in his own right. So obviously he speaks from a bunch of knowledge that way. And I think it's important that you also talk a little bit about the mental side, because that always comes into play. And we keep hearing this term mental health these days. You know, when we were growing up, they didn't even know what ADD or ADHD or any of that stuff does. Sometimes they didn't even know what PTSD was. So the science has come a long way and is diagnosed, kind of overdiagnosed sometimes in some areas. Mm-hmm. But from the standpoint of, because you got to to play successfully anything, you've got to keep a focused mind. And when you're going under physical therapy, whatever it is, it's super important to focus your mind because it's difficult and you're doing difficult things to a part of your body that wasn't difficult at one time.
Absolutely. So just for your knowledge and background too, you know, most occupational therapists have a pretty extensive background in the psychology space or the mental health background. It's sort of one of the origins of the profession and helping soldiers after World War One from shell shock or what later became PTSD and so on and so forth. And so like some of my clinical rotations, my first clinical rotation was actually in an inpatient psychiatric facility and a state hospital. So this is part of our training and so on and so forth. So I reference that to say that, you know, typically occupational therapists have a pretty strong familiarity with mental health and its relation to function, participation, activity, and so on and so forth. And these are some key skills that we share and pass on to our residents and fellows, whether they're occupational therapists, physical therapists, because they're just incredibly valuable. And golfer or otherwise, you know, a number of pieces from the mental side play a massive, massive role. And it's actually one of the things that I'll hand out. Let's say you were coming to see me as a golfer or for a performance or if this is something rehab-wise, still have folks complete an occupational profile. And there's a section there regarding mental health. And I think it's a very important thing to be in there. Like, hey, do I have a hard time focusing on this? Do I ever have sort of maybe some thoughts where my thoughts are kind of racing and I'm having a hard time controlling them and that sort of stuff. Things that we see on a regular basis that can certainly impact a rehab outcome are certainly things as people grieve through this whole process. We'll see phases of depression, phases of anger, phases of hopefully eventually acceptance, but also things like you mentioned in terms of ADD or anxiety these aren't like the easiest things to just sort of treat and fixed it, got it. But they can really make it very challenging for somebody to feel comfortable in a rehabilitative setting or in a hospital setting and to navigate their way through recovering from something. So obviously clinicians, OTs and PTs, not just at the Johns Hopkins University, but around the country at all sorts of facilities are very familiar with these things, and we spend a good deal of time learning about them for this exact reason.
You know, all the physical therapists I've been around, and they interestingly enough learn processes along the way as well, because I guess not every injury is the same. It may be called the same thing, but it's not necessarily the same.
Absolutely. It's kind of amazing. So I'll get asked all the time, don't you get bored kind of just seeing just upper extremity stuff, you know, aren't you? Like, I mean, I don't know if I see the same thing. You know, I could see somebody who had a joint in their thumb replaced.
Ooh,
and
nice.
I could see five other people.
Oh, well, that's a good place to pick up our next segment with Rice. Vincent, he's going to wrap the show with us after this break, but fascinating stuff indeed. We'll be back with Rye after this break. We are back to wrap up the show, and it's been a pleasure to spend time with Rye Stinson. You'll probably hear more from him throughout the year because fascinating stuff. And also, I don't know that we got a mental guru already in Dr. Bob Winters, and we have a bunch of instructors like some guy named Mark Sheftick that both of us may or may not know or admit that we know, and such. And of course, the great Jim McLean will be coming back and instructors of that ilk as well. But you know, to have be able to break it down, and I know on the last show we talked about one of our favorite guys, Dr. Greg Rose, and I have a long history with him. Anybody who listens to this show knows that. But also, you know, but the work through of the body, the biomechanics, and all the big words mm-hmm. that get thrown out mm-hmm. there or whatever are fascinating because it's all a bunch of science. But when you break it down, people have relatability, and that's the most important thing. And I'm sure you'll tell me this. I'm correct from a physical therapist standpoint, because if people can understand where the pain originates from or what they're doing or what they should be doing, it's a game changer.
Absolutely. I mean, knowledge is empowering. And I think, Greg with a strong engineering background, and every engineer that I've ever treated, for sure, in every imaginable variety, from nuclear to mechanical, civil, whatever. And half my family on one side is a bunch of engineers. And the idea for, hey, if I can measure, why wouldn't I measure? Why wouldn't I take that step to gain information to help improve my understanding and so on and so forth? That's a fantastic thing. And at the same time, it's also really important to have a good understanding that what we say and how we say it, especially as a healthcare provider, oftentimes really sticks with folks. Right? We try pretty hard not to avoid these scenarios where we're creating these little neuro tags like, hey, you've got this, therefore you're going to have that, right? Sometimes that can be kind of overwhelming. I mean, kind of scary. Like I totally said I had this, and now, you know, I'm over here thinking I've caught the worst possible thing in the world, when I might have, you know, I might move toward the golf ball a little bit in the swing and so on and so forth. Being able to correlate those things and being able to recognize patterns and guide practice and treatment and learning in the directions which you're going with somebody is an amazing, awesome thing. But then being able to break this down, as you say, in a way that's very digestible and make some good old quality sense is really the key thing. You can tell things, you can list things, you have a summary of things. The level of learning that we like to see people get to is when they're able to own some of these things and teach them back and truly reach a level of understanding, which is not necessarily something I expect out of everyone on day one. The only expectation I have is a presence for, hey, I'm here to learn. This is kind of cool. So that's probably a huge piece that sort of glues all of that together, because that's such a huge part of the game. And I think I mentioned in the last segment or another segment I was on that, you know, the modern day golf instruction studio looks an awful lot like a research lab. And there's so many great things from that. And there's also so many things that we just have to make sure that stays approachable and digestible, understandable, as we continue to learn more and more about the swing, which is a fantastic and just fascinating thing in general.
That fascinating summary there, Rye, my friend, because I'm going to tell Jim McLean next time I talk to him, because he has a laboratory, so to speak, right? It's a research facility. And I think he'll appreciate that, because he's reworking his X Factor book, and that's going to come out in a number of weeks. And, he's really at the forefront of a lot of that stuff that you were talking about. So it's interesting to call it a research laboratory disguised as a golf teaching facility.
Oh, no, I don't know about disguise. I mean, you know, we get to stand awfully tall on the shoulders of a lot of people before us in general, just as I'm sure Jim and Greg have stood on and so on and so forth. And hopefully I'll be fortunate enough to continue to stand on and their shoulders and so on and so forth. But doing the work that they're doing to collect this information and make some sense of it and churn it out and learn from things that they learn from and so on and so forth, that's just a great thing, you know, and I think we're all probably trying to do the same.
As we close out the show, and I really appreciate your time, Rye, what would you call yourself? If you had one term to call yourself, a research maniac, maniacal.
I don't know.
All right, fine. We'll let him think about it for a while, and we'll invite him back on. And you better have the answer next time. That's his homework. But Rye Stinson, my guest on TV with Keith Jones of Johns Hopkins fame. We're just out of time. Get out there and practice your game. Practice. Take your game to the next level, and we will talk to you next week. Take care.